Welcome to Days in the Wild. I just want to talk to you real quick before we jump into this next episode. I can't urge you enough to get out there and give us a review on iTunes or the Podbean app. It's super important. Helps me keep this free, helps me reach new people and continue to grow. If you don't know how to do that, hit me up and I'll help you through it. Also want you to go and give Phoenix Shooting Bags a look. Check out their website, phoenixshootingbags.com. They are our main sponsor and they put an excellent product out, and it means a lot for me for you to go check them out and take a look and see what they got. So without further ado, let's roll into this next episode.
Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild, Big Game Hunting Podcast. We're talking mule deer with my buddy Henry Ferguson today. What's going on, man? How are you?
Man, I am just getting ready to head out the door for Total Archery Challenge. So I've been doing a little bit of deathbed repentance with my bow over the last couple of weeks, just trying to make sure everything is dialed and dialed and dialed. And I mean, that's pretty much what I got going on now.
Yeah.
So ready to go out and see how it all plays out now.
That's awesome. I mean, I have not shot my bow a lot this year. And you would think with all the testing that I'm doing, I've been shooting it at a dot, you know, so that doesn't help very much when it comes to shooting deer. Because I noticed I went and did a little bit of 3D shooting the other day, and I'm having a hard time holding my pin where I want it because I'm so used to looking at a dot. But I was using a Hooter shooter for all the vane testing, for when I was dialing in the arrows, and then for the broadhead testing that we did, that I really wasn't shooting my bow enough, and then I could tell. So.
So it's interesting because you've spent a lot of time with a bow. You just right. haven't been the one operating it. So, and it's funny, John, I was actually looking over your vane testing and your broadhead testing this morning, and I really enjoyed that. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who are really going to benefit from that.
Yeah.
A lot of good info in there.
I hope so. I hope so, because I spent a lot of time, a lot of money. You know, those FBI jobs are like $1,000 I spent on an FBI job.
Holy cow, are you serious?
They're not cheap, man. Not cheap at all. And like, already I got a couple of like the broadhead manufacturers texted me this morning after reading it, and they were kind of, you know, I had a couple of them that were a little upset. I'm like, man, the data is the data. I don't like, I really
I'm
don't
sure.
know.
Oh, like, and I'm sure.
For you. You know,
yeah, and unfortunately, you know, I mean, that was as unbiased a test as you could possibly give. I mean, it was facts. It was just facts, you know, and that's all there is to
right.
it.
Right. Right. So. Exactly. So, I felt bad, you know, and one of the guys that contacted me this morning, their head actually performed very well, but I never said anything about it at the end. But their score was good.
And gotcha.
Like if I give kudos to every head, then it kind of waters down what my opinion is, you know?
It does. So. And you know, it's interesting because I noticed, you know, hey, you've shot a certain brand of broadheads for a long time.
Right.
And they tested out pretty well, but I mean, it wasn't, you know, you were still unbiased in how you presented everything. I mean, you know, again, like I said,
I don't even shoot for them anymore. I stopped shooting for them this year. That's part of one of the reasons why I went down this road. It's because I'm, you know, looking for see what I want to shoot next.
Yeah, see what else is out there.
It's funny
because a few years ago I went through and I've shot the same fletching combination for a long time. And I decided, you know, I've shot these for a long time, but I've shot them for a long time just because they've never let me down. You know, it's been a reliable setup. So I set up a whole quiver full of different combinations and had three of each so I could, you know, get a true group representation on it. and shot those for, gosh, almost 2 months. And I mean, my quiver looked like Noah's Ark, you know. I mean, it had but three of everything instead of two. But I mean, had a lot of different combinations in there, and I shot them all. And then at the end of the day, I went back to what I was shooting because I found that nothing else was outperforming it, and I already had confidence in that. So it just made sense to stick with what I had. But if nothing else, it showed me that it did make sense to go down that path. You know, it made sense to do the work and gave me a lot more confidence in my own setup.
Right. Yeah. And you know, for me, like it's kind of the exact opposite right now. Like I'm in limbo land, like having tested all these heads, like I don't know which way to go. Like, because on one hand, like you said, I was with a company for a long time, and the head performed well. There's some things like, listen, we're talking about Schwacker. Obviously, most people know that I shot Schwacker for a long time.
And yeah.
It's a good performing head, but it's not a very well made head. Okay, so they're throwaways. You're never going to shoot that head into an animal more than one. You're never going to
pick
it back up. You're never going to pick it back up. Every once in a while, because of their manufacturing process, you're going to get a head that doesn't shoot great. Tolerances may not be as good. Okay, and there's some, like, for instance, when we were in Argentina and I was shooting at Red Stags, something like I never had a problem shooting an elk with a Schwacker ever. Never. If I lost a couple of elk in archery with those heads, but not because of the head. It's because I made a shitty ass shot and hit him in the ass. You know, didn't matter what head I shot him with. It wasn't gonna kill that thing.
Yeah, but there's times where nothing's bailing you out.
Exactly. You know, so here's my experience in Argentina. I'll give you two scenarios. I had a rough time there. I had a rough time, even though I killed three stags. I don't know if you listened to the whole story and how it all transpired, but I effectively lost all three of those, or sorry, two of those three stags. I lost them and end up getting second opportunity on them days later. So, but the one that I did kill, you know, first try, I shot with my Schwacker at 50 yards, and it was a perfect heart-lung shot. He ran like 20 yards, stood behind a bush, and because he was still standing, and at this point I already had lost one, I pumped him with three more arrows. So I hit him four times.
Hey, I agree with you. That move 100%. I mean, my policy is if they're still standing, I'm still shooting.
Exactly.
Weird things can happen with bows.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, but now the ones that I lost, one I hit kind of high because he ducked. And I have the video and I've watched it a million times and I'm watching the flight of the arrow. And I didn't shoot my Schwacker with that one. I shot a little fixed blade single bevel, that a 1-inch cut single bevel, because I got such shitty penetration on the one that I did kill with the Schwacker.
Gotcha. Right?
Now I shoot this thing and it ducks a little bit, and I know in my heart of hearts, had I shot it with the Schwacker, because it's a 2-inch cut, I would have clipped the top of his lungs and he would have been done. But no, because I shot the little 1-inch deal. It's like, you know, there's all these things. And the more I go down these roads in engineering, you always have to give up something to get something.
That's a fact.
So it's finding this happy medium in between. So like, you know, for instance, with a mechanical, you're picking up, you know, flight, field point accuracy, whatever. And you're picking up the ability to shoot a much bigger blade or much bigger cutting, but you're losing kinetic energy, so you don't always get two holes. You're not, because it takes kinetic energy to open up the blades. Anyhow, so
Yeah.
That being said, it's got my wheels turning so much that like now I've erased all the confidence that I had for the past 11 years that I was shooting a Schwacker. and I haven't built a confidence in anything else, because when you look at the numbers, none of them were, I mean, there was some that were really shitty, but when you come to the top seven, they were very, very close to each other. So it's not like there was one like that was so outstanding and such an outlier that it was like, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and truly, I think a lot of the equipment that we use nowadays, whether it's broadheads, arrows, bows, I mean, there are a lot of right choices to be made. You know what I mean? And it's just, I mean, we've got a lot of the manufacturing processes have improved. I mean, everything's improved. And it's given us a lot of good options, but you know, it just kind of boils down to making the decision that works for you, really.
Right, right, exactly. So, Anyway, I digress. I'll let you know. I'm going to make up my mind here soon. I'm going to have to, obviously, knocking on the door here. Around the corner here, and we're July 9th right now. Our season here in Arizona, I'm going to hunt here, starts late August, but that's quick. That's coming up quick.
Yeah, the clock is ticking. That's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah. And it's kind of funny. I mean, have you tried any of the compromises and like the hybrid heads?
Yeah. And you know what? I don't like any of the hybrid heads.
Okay, and I personally haven't shot one. That's why I was that was a genuine question. I haven't. I mean, I've shot fixed heads with a good deal of success, and I've shot mechanicals for the last 10, 12 years with a great deal of success. And you know, it's just a matter of kind of picking but I thought that hybrid might be what you're looking for there. But
so you know. That's a yes and no. So I actually have done a lot of testing of hybrids off book, and that were not included in this. I only included those people who I contacted and wanted to be a part of it.
Okay.
Well, that's not entirely true. There was one or two in there that I selfishly threw in because I wanted to see what they would do. But
sure.
The hybrid thing is a double-edged sword. And what I found was that yes, with a hybrid, you definitely make a lot of trauma, but, and you can see on the few that I did test, the hybrids, you don't get a whole lot of penetration, and there's a lot of drag on the hybrids, more so than that would be on a fixed blade. And so they don't fly as good. They are louder, and you run the risk of having poor penetration, even though you make a bigger hole. So I have theories about it. I shouldn't just say theories. I'm trying not to let the cat out of the bag. I developed a head myself, and it is, I guess you would call it a hybrid. It's a hybrid because it has cut on contact blades on it. And it does have a mechanical blade feature, but the cut on contact are more like bleeders as opposed to having a full, like, you know, a 1-inch or 1.25-inch blade. Some of these hybrids have even 3/4 inches is much. What I found was that if you have a mechanical that has a bleeder that's really small, it eliminates the sucking wound, and if you have a single bevel on your entrance and then it deploys, it could be a double bevel or continue to be a single bevel at that point, you have good wound channels and the opening doesn't close up like it can and suck in the fur like it can.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, I've developed a broadhead that kind of eliminates all that. I did a bunch of testing with it. I even printed it up in plastic and shot it. And the design in plastic actually penetrates better than some of the aluminum ones that I shot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's, so just, and you know, it's one of those things that I guess that doesn't surprise me too much, because if you have the blade angle right, man, that makes such a huge difference in how those broadheads perform, how they really get through the flesh and through the animal itself, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I learned a lot of things. And again, like, I'm not going to take away from the testing that I did, and I don't want to reveal some of the stuff that I did in the background that is not part of the test.
Sure.
But I actually found what I think might be the secret sauce. The best of all worlds. The happy balance, the happy medium between everything, you know? Like I said, because you always have to give up something to get something. So anyway, that being said, we'll leave it at that. Who knows? There might be a John Stallone broadhead coming out. We'll see.
There you go. Well, I can't wait to see it. Can't wait to see it if you do.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's, I've always been that way. I don't know if I ever told you this or not. We've had so many conversations, and I've had so many conversations with people that I don't remember who I tell to what, but you know, I kind of first start out in this industry was product testing and helping companies develop their products better, you know, to make them better. Give it to me. I wrote it through the ringer, and then I would, you know, give them my feedback. And then from there, you know, they go for it. And I did that with everything from backpacks, broadheads, scent elimination products, clothing, you name it. And I don't have an engineering background. I have a very engineering mind, but I don't have an engineering background per se.
Anyway, gotcha.
So I have you on, not to talk about me and my brands, but
no problem. Hey, I asked a question.
So I'd like to hear if you could share a couple of stories with us, or of times where you learned something about hunting mule deer that, or a hunt that maybe changed the way you hunt mule deer, or had an aha moment, whatever.
You know what? I do. I've got one that really came to mind there. It was a buck that I hunted in 2018. We called him Bedhead. And he was a really cool looking buck, big typical side. And then his other side with a couple cheaters on it. And then his other side looked like it grew, instead of kind of going out away from, you know, parallel with his ears and up, it grew almost straight up out of his head. And I got a stalk on this buck with like a week and a half left in the season. I'd been hunting a real big typical, and finally he was just kicking my butt, and I decided I'd go hunt this other buck's bedhead. And he was pretty patternable. He was bedding in one of three or four different spots. And so one day when I put him to bed, I knew right where he was going. I saw him feeding up the hill, and I knew right where he was headed. So I'm glassing him from, you know, probably almost 2 miles away. So I had to get back down the mountain up the other side of the valley. You know, I mean, it's a trek. So get over there, and I sneak in on this buck, and he's in this little patch of aspens. And I mean a little patch of aspens. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, man, he was just in a really, really good stalkable position. And so as I make my approach, I get in close, and I mean too close, but I'm probably 10 to 15 feet away from this buck, and he is bedded and doesn't have a clue I even exist. Wind's in my face, and had I come in the other direction, I would have had a better shot at him, but the wind would have been blowing straight in his face, and I probably never would have even seen him bedded, because he would have just taken off on me. But so I snuck in, and I'm close, and my strategy has been sit and wait. Just wait it out. If a shot doesn't present itself, if there's not a shot there right then, just be patient, you know, and wait for him to slip up, wait for him to stand up and make a little bit of a mistake. Well, I had two really good friends who are just outstanding deer hunters, and both of them had said to me before the season, like, man, you're crazy waiting on those bucks. You got to stand them up. So I'm like, okay, I can do this. I can do this. So I'm sitting there again, close range on this buck. I've got my sight set for, you know, not 20 yards because they're way closer. He's way closer than that.
Oh, wow.
And so I've got my sight set, got narrow knocked, take a breath, draw back, and I'm just, my pen is sitting right where I know he's about to stand up. And I decided I would do a little cow elk call, just a little meow. And I started out pretty quiet and nothing, not even a reaction. I could see his ears. And so, I mean, if he was going to, you know, if his ears were going to move or twitch, I was definitely going to see it. And right, nothing, right, just right. Not a reaction at all. So I came back again a little bit louder, still at full draw. And this time his ears kind of twitch and turn a little bit, and you see his head kind of turn, but he still can't see me, can't smell me, can't hear me other than my stupid animal sounds I'm making. But he's still not standing up. I'm like, oh my gosh. So literally I've been at full draw for probably close to a minute. And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to let down. There's really no harm in it. It's a quiet, you know, my rest is quieted down and everything. So I let down and I'm sitting here thinking about it. I'm going, okay, do I just mew like a cow again? What, you know, like a cow elk again? What do I do? And so I sat there, I thought about it for a couple minutes, and there had been some cattle in this area, and it was really weird because there's the nearest ranch is like 4.5-5 miles away as the crow flies. And trust me, there's no cattle walking the crow flight path on this place. So,
right.
But I had seen the cattle in there 2 or 3 times over the summer. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do a little moo cow. So I'm changing my cow techniques here. I'd gone from mew cow to a moo cow. And so I gave it a little light moo and nothing. So I come back a few seconds, you know, 10, 15 seconds later, I moo a little bit louder again. And now, you know, his head is up and he is turning around looking for the source of this noise and he cannot figure it out. Once again, after about a minute, I'm like, holy crap, I can't believe I'm letting down again. But I literally let down on him twice. But I let down that second time and I'm like, okay, I don't even know what to do at this point. Now he obviously knows something's there. You can see that he's a little more nervous and he's totally hidden. And I forgot to mention, all I could see of this buck was his rack.
That's all I wanted to ask you this whole time. I'm just like,
yeah, sorry.
Shoot him in his bed.
Yo, no, trust me. If there was a shot in his bed, he would have been dead before I ever made a peep. But there was
because I know there's a lot of guys that won't shoot when they're in their bed. Like, I don't.
Oh man,
like,
not I me. I said that. That is my preferred shot. In fact, I'll get to that here in a little bit. But okay. So all I can see is his ears. I can see his whole rack and I can see his ears. So I give it a few minutes and I'm like, all right, I'm going to change the strategy once again. And this time I just grunted like a buck, you know, just a little meh. And that time he didn't stand. He didn't look. He pretty much got out of his bed and bolted about 30 yards. And so I'm trying to, you know, I'm adjusting because he is standing out there 30 yards. My sight, I think, was set for 40, if my memory serves. And so I'm like, oh, I got this. And literally, as soon as I got my bow over to him, I mean, he was gone. He just took off. So My lesson I learned on this buck on that encounter was there's so many variables, you know. I mean, I snuck in and I took somebody else's advice on that. And instead of going with what's worked for me over the years, which is just patience, sitting there and waiting them out, waiting for them to make a mistake, I forced the issue. And that's not been something that I've had a lot of success with in the past, but these guys are dang good hunters. I'm like, I'm going to trust their opinions on this. So anyway, buck runs off. And now let's fast forward to 9 days later, the second to last day of the season. Okay. And I've got my son out there with me. I'm up on that same glassing point and I see the buck. Once I see him out there, and he has half stripped his velvet that day, stripped literally the top half of his rack. And I'm sitting here thinking, he's going to finish the job. And when he does, I'm going to cover as much ground as fast as I can, try to get in there and get him. Well, this buck just fed the rest of the morning with velvet hanging down off his rack. And I watched him bed down and he was totally by himself. And I've always felt that solo bucks are the easiest bucks to kill because they're just not as, you know, you only have to beat one set of eyes, one nose, one set of ears, rather than, you know, all these bachelor herds that have bucks stacked, you know, end to end on them. And so anyway, I thought, well, we just might be able to make this happen. So we watched him for a while, made sure he was staying in that bed. And we made went back down to the truck a mile, then drove the truck up a little ways just to cut some of the distance off, and then came in from a different direction. So make this big loop around and we get up over the top. And, you know, again, keep in mind, my son was 12 at the time and he'd been on a couple successful hunts with my wife with a rifle, but never a successful hunt, I should say, with me with a bow. He's been going out with me since he was a little tiny kid. But so anyway, we take our boots off, slip on an extra pair of socks at about 200 yards, and we are creeping down this hill. And he's bedded kind of under some rocks, but not really in the rocks. There's some brush under the rocks, and that's where he's bedded out by the brush. So we creep down to the rocks and get there, you know, pretty quickly. And the first set of rocks, we kind of peek over and I don't see him. I'm like, oh man. So now we creep up a little bit farther. I mean, literally like 10, 15 feet farther. I peek up and I see antler tips in the brush. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I get my son's attention. He peeks over and he looks back at me and his eyes are just, you know, the size of baseballs. I mean, just this shock of, you know, holy cow, this is working. And so anyway, I've already got an arrow knocked. I ranged the bush next to him and it's like 31, 32 yards and he's still bedded. He's looking the other way. So as soon as I pop my head up over, I'm already at full draw. I rise up the rest of the way and he turns to look. And he turned a little bit too late because that arrow was already gone and he was dead. I mean, that buck was dead before he even got up. But but he got up and took like I think he took like 7 or 8 big bounds down the hill and just got the jelly legs and fell over dead. But it was, you know, to be able to share that with my son was amazing. I mean, that was really cool. But the lesson I learned on hunting that buck is be true to the tactics that work for you. You know, don't change your style. Don't change your methods just because somebody else is, you know, giving you put an idea in your head. But and the other lesson I learned on that was, I mean, I took it down to the second to last day of the season. All right. And I mean, I wanted so badly to get a buck, you know, to get a deer with my son there that, you know, and we were seeing little bucks all over the place, but we weren't seeing that good mature buck. So staying focused on what your scouting has taught you is real beneficial. You know, just staying true to that. You know, I knew there was a good buck in the area, and I knew I needed to stay on it and stay hunting that spot to be able to have a chance at it. And even, you know, sure, it could have happened on the first day of the season, but it just so happened it ended up happening like 27 days later. And, you know, had I just bailed and shot a lesser buck, you know, I would have missed out on one of my coolest deer I've ever shot.
And that experience with your son. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. I mean, that was cool. When I looked over at him, cause you know, like I said, we shot him and I shot and I said, keep eyes on him. And he's watching. And like I said, he takes those big strides down the hill and he didn't go 60 yards. And when he tipped over, I looked over and Kyle just goes, "Holy crap, Dad, that was amazing." So yeah, it was pretty neat. But you know, it was a good reminder. You just gotta stay at it. Whether it's the first day or the last day of the hunt, you need to stay focused and working hard at accomplishing your goal, and it could happen any day.
Yeah, no, I just did a podcast with Kip Fowler.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was saying something along the same lines, you know, it's never giving up, you know, and just keep going and don't get, you know, it's like stuff happens out there and it's going to happen, but yeah. Don't let it discourage you. Just stick to your game and eventually, you know, the pieces will fall into place. You know,
yeah, and that's what it boils down to. I mean, you have to have confidence in yourself, in the skills that you have as an archer in this case, you know, or you know, the time you put in behind your rifle, knowing that everything is dialed in as well as you can possibly make it. And then also having the confidence knowing that the scouting, all the work, all the hard work you put into it leading up to the season is paying off as well. You know, I mean, you know, those animals are in there. If you haven't completely blown them out, they're going to stay. I mean, there's not, obviously there's, you know, there's migration issues and stuff that you can run into on some deer, but I know for a fact, these bucks don't move. They don't leave that spot unless I blow it and make them leave that spot.
Right. And even then, they probably come back in a couple of days.
They do. They do. And it's anywhere from 24 to 72 hours later. But, you know, I mean, hey, that same season, I shot a buck and shot him right through the back straps. I mean, he just absolutely dropped on me at pretty darn close range and just dropped at the. I mean, it was a pretty agitated situation. I'd snuck in close and he was trying to slip out and I grunted at him. He stopped and I took my shot at like 27 yards and he just dropped, man. The moment that arrow was released, he dropped and it went straight through the back straps. And it was 5 days later that I saw that buck back. And I stalked him two more times throughout the season, and he never really left his core area. I mean, he disappeared for 5 days or 4 days, whatever it was, you know, kind of recovering from that wound. And when I saw him again, you know, all those days later, he was literally walking around. He reached back and licked that wound twice in the morning that I watched him, but he wasn't in a huntable spot. But, you know, it was a place where I just couldn't make an approach without being seen, you know, 200 yards before I got close enough for a shot. But,
let me ask you this. Sure. On in this area, does it see a lot of, like, hiking traffic and stuff like that?
This is kind of on the edge. It's kind of on the edge of an area that sees some, but I try to avoid the hiking traffic as much as I possibly can.
The reason why I was asking is because I found a correlation that in areas where bucks are used to seeing humans and those humans not approaching them aggressively, you know, not sneaking on them or anything like that, or wearing scary camouflage, that if you do bump them, they tend to come back pretty quick.
And you know what? That could be a valid point. I mean, really, because they have experience with the people, but you know, they are so smart. They're so perceptive in picking up whatever cues we give off as hunters, you know, whether it's sneaking along rather than just walking and talking with our friends or whatever it is. But man, they can sure tell when people turn from, you know, just casual hiker to predator.
Right. Well, if you show body positions of predator, as soon as you hunch over a little bit, they automatically know you're a predator. I mean, how many times you've been out there walking along, bippity-boppity down the trail, wearing a white t-shirt, and the buck standing right in front of you, freaking 20 yards, and just staring at you?
Enough times that it drives me freaking crazy. Right.
So actually, I have a friend that he calls it the lost tourist approach. And he'll just keep walking. He'll find a buck, and he'll just keep, you know, stay in plain sight of them, walking them around and around in circles and like bending over, picking up rocks, whatever, just not paying attention. And sooner or later, that circle gets close enough that he can shoot.
That's funny.
I don't think it hasn't worked for him with whitetail, but for mule deer, it does for sure. Like, okay, to give you for instance, the other day, there's rabbits in front of my house. Those rabbits will let me get, if I'm just kind of like not looking at them and walking like I'm not looking at them, they'll just stand there. As soon as I turn my eyes and look at them like I'm focusing on them, those fuckers run, you know? It's like they know.
Again, they can tell.
When you're in predator mode versus... I actually got a good story from a couple of years back. My cousin Paul had a pretty good late season rifle tag here in Arizona. And it was the last day of his hunt, and I spotted up. I finally found him a good buck. He was having a hard, we just had a shit year. We couldn't find really good bucks. And I found him a good buck, bedded down. He was with like five or six does, because those late season hunts during the rut.
And
we had the sun in our face because we were close enough to shoot him from where we were at. But because the way the sun was, Paul couldn't see him in the scope. And if he stood up, he wasn't going to be able to get a shot. So I said, okay, Paul, listen, we're going to have to drop off this. We're going to have to go across this flat and get to where that group of trees are. And you're going to lay down in the shade. The sun's going to be, you know, quartering to us, you know, almost more to our right than it is going to be in front of us like it is right now. It's direct in our face. We get down there, we're going to be able to make the shot. I said, but let me go check to be 100% sure. So I went and I dropped off and I got behind this tree line and I walked real slow, made my way over there, got down, classed him back up, picked him back up. I said, okay, oh yeah. I radioed up to Paul. I'm like, all right, you and Gasper come down. Our buddy Gasper was with us. I said, you guys come down. Come across this flat. I said, you know, move with purpose, but
don't,
like, and I even told him, I said, don't hunch over. And I said, just stand up nice and just walk. We're far enough away that even if they see you, I mean, we're 500 yards. Even if they see you, they're not going to run. Okay. So just, what did those two dummies do? They hunched over and they look like two coyotes coming across the flat. The whole fucking herd stands up, stares right at them. Paul gets to me just in time to watch this buck in the scope.
Oh, man.
I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, like, Jesus Christ. Like, I did exactly what I told you not to do. But anyway, that's a perfect example of what, you know, of that same situation, basically.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because I don't want people to think that I'm closed-minded and won't try new tactics, because I do all the time. But man, that last little bit, I'm waiting.
Yeah,
I'm just waiting. That's all there is to it, you know.
Yeah, and I could see it from their standpoint.
I mean, ideally, I'd love to sneak in and have a shot at them bedded like I did ultimately on this buck. But, you know, that's my goal every time. And this last year, I mean, I snuck in on another buck real close to that one. And he was the way he was bedded. All I could see was his rack and his ears sticking up. But he was, you know, these old bucks they're smart. I mean, they know how to pick those beds where they're pretty darn safe. So.
Right. But no, and I could see it from your buddy's standpoint too. You know, you're in that close and you got to sit there. The longer you wait, you risk the wind changing or, you know, getting too antsy and moving around too much. You know, I guess there's a million things that could go wrong. Actually, I don't even like being that close. Every time I'm that close, I blow it.
Yeah. And
I'd rather have a 50-yard shot than a 15-yard shot sometimes.
You know what? I'm 100% with you. And I think that there's a couple reasons why. I mean, first of all, they're a lot less jacked up when they see it. If they stand up and see something 50 yards away, they are more likely to stay calm for a second while you get your shot off than if they stand up and see you 15 yards away. And I mean, you know, you're in well within the attack zone of whatever predator is out there. And they just right. don't like that stuff, man. And I can't say I blame them.
yeah, for sure. So you got another good story for us or?
That's the only one that comes to mind right now, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that, I guess another story there is I snuck in on that big buck that I was chasing that year just a few days before my first encounter with Bedhead. And he was bedded out in this valley, and there was pretty tall brush around, but it was little like islands of brush. It wasn't a solid sea of it. Right. And so I was sneaking in on him and just had a really squirrely wind that day. And it was staying primarily in my face, but it was shifting, you know, off a bit as well. And so I knew that I knew going into it, I'm like, man, if anything blows this hunt, this stock, it's probably going to be the freaking wind. And sure enough, it was. But basically, I got in there and I was at, I think I was at like 60 yards, and he was bedded, but he had some branches in front of his body, and it just wasn't, you know, there wasn't a shot. And I knew if I got to the other side of this bush that I was behind, so I'm on the right side of it, I figured if I could get to the left side of it, I was going to have a shot at him because those little branches wouldn't be in my way. So in the time it took me to go about 10 to 12 feet, that wind just finally betrayed me. And it just came straight at my back. And when I covered the rest of that 12 feet, all I could see was his butt and antlers walking away from me. And he knew, I mean, he caught the scent, obviously, because I don't think he would have seen me. And he definitely didn't hear me, but boy, he just walked away, you know, just lost that opportunity. So, and I think that was kind of my frustration in that hunt that I took, you know, it was probably the real reason why I took that stock, because it was not a high percentage stock by any means with that wind shifting like that. I probably should have just waited that out another day, but yeah, I kind of bird dogged him and just stayed on him for a little while. And I got to him and I had another time I got into him at like 85 yards, but it was, you know, it was just too brushy. And another time he gave me one last look at like 150, and I'm sitting there going, man, why do I bug it? But yeah,
I said that's the reason why I don't shoot a slider, because I know I'd be tempted to reach up there and dial her up to 120.
I do, and believe me, John, I was sitting there dialing my sight, and I'm going, he's 150 yards. That's not a shot I should be taking. So, yeah, I wanted to, believe me, but, you know, hey, it's I guess that's kind of one of the lessons that you learn as hunters, that just because you want it and just because you work really hard for it does not mean it's always going to work out. And, right. You know, it's a good metaphor for life, you know, good teaches you some good lessons in how to deal with disappointment.
For sure. you gotta be used to dealing with disappointment when you're a bow hunter, for sure.
Oh man. I'll tell you what, I think, my job, I'm in sales, and I think my job and archery mule deer hunting have a lot in common. You have to become comfortable hearing the word no, and right. not let it affect your entire psyche and mental well-being, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
because I experienced that plenty in both. But yeah, that was a lesson, a year filled with lessons for me. And ultimately, I was real pleased with how it worked out. I mean, don't get me wrong, that other buck scored well into the 190s and, you know, would have looked fantastic on my wall. I had the perfect spot for him, but he just didn't want to play. He didn't want to be part of my bachelor herd in my living room. So, but was real pleased, you know, coming out with a good buck at the end of it too. Was definitely a nice way to finish out the season.
For sure. Well, awesome, man. I'll let you get to that archery total archery challenge. Good luck to you. I'm sure you'll be fine.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I've shot it a couple times in Utah and really looking forward to shooting it here in Colorado. I mean, it's a 3-hour drive for me there. So,
where is it out in Colorado, Ken, this year?
It's at Sunlight Resort. It's over by, it's a ski resort over kind of by between Glenwood Springs and Aspen, I believe.
Okay.
So, right. Yeah.
I was kind of hoping they did one. They were going to do it, you know, like close to like Durango or something like that, where it's only like a 6-hour drive for me. But they had a pretty cool event here called Hike to Hunt up in Flagstaff.
Yeah, that was just last weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was up there. I was up there with my family, but I couldn't get the get out of jail free card for my wife.
But, hey, gotta take care of the family in the off season, because they sure put up with a lot during the season. I mean, my family does anyway. I don't know about everybody else's, but yeah.
Mine does, for sure. Between hunting and guiding and everything else, I'm gone a lot. So
yeah,
I can't bitch. I cannot bitch at all.
That's a fact. Yeah.
All right, buddy. Well, it's always good talking to you, and good luck
out
there.
Hey, you too, John.
We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me on.
All right. You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Bye.